This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
I don't even know how to start this. We made it. We made it to Amsterdam.
We did make it to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Andrew, barely, but... All right, well, we are here in Amsterdam at Rails World. We have Adam Wathen with us, creator of Tailwind CSS, and want to just catch up and talk about front-end programming in our favorite programming framework, Ruby on Rails. So thanks for sitting down with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is exciting to be able to do this in person in this cool Dutch booth.
Box, the hot box.
The hot box, yeah,
Chris
literally.
Is Dutch sweating.
I recorded a podcast in here earlier, and I walked up to Jason. I was like, Jason, I need to warn you. It's going to be hot.
Yeah. Well, we only got a sweaty hour together.
In 45 minutes, when people walk by, and there's four men shirtless. It's just Rails World. Well, Adam, is this your first Ruby or Rails-related conference you've been to?
Yeah. First ever.
What's the vibe for you so far?
So far, it's good, man. This is like a really well-produced event. I'm really surprised, actually, by like how crazy it is. Some of that, I think, is like some additional perspective after running our own event in the summer. And just realizing how hard it is even to get like a piece of fabric with a logo on it made. And then you come here and there's just like all this custom signage, like that crazy big like Rails custom fabricated letters that they had out front, and that like really thoughtful history of Ruby and Rails thing where they had people like being able to sign their name and stuff like that. Just lots of like really impressive details put into everything that like once you've done your own thing, man, you realize like how much time and effort goes into making every single one of those things happen. So it's a really awesome conference so far.
Yeah. I think it's one of the most exciting conferences I've been to in a while.
Yeah,
for sure.
Tailwind, was it Tailwind Connect? Was that the name?
Yeah, that's what we called it. Yep. Yeah, it was great. It started as like we were doing a team retreat, and we did the team retreat in my hometown because I was going to be having a kid within 6 weeks of that. So I kind of just couldn't travel because you never know, like babies show up whenever, or there could be complications or whatever. But we wanted to do another team retreat. So we figured, okay, everyone just fly to Adam, and that way he doesn't have to leave. And we just thought, well, why don't we have a little Tailwind meetup while everyone's in town? That'd be kind of fun. And then the little Tailwind meetup turned into, let's book this venue that people book for like weddings and create a big website and just spend $85,000 on AV stuff. And next thing you know, we had 220 people there flying in from like Germany and all over the place, just an hour and a half keynote and 2 hours of networking. And it was fun. It was the first time we've ever had like any in-person Tailwind anything. There's never been like a Tailwind reason to be in one place. Obviously, you go to Laracon or something, you can meet a lot of other people that use Tailwind, or here, there's lots of people who use Tailwind. It was the first like Tailwind-branded event. So it was the first time I ever got to be in a room with people who are all just there because they like Tailwind, which was like a really cool feeling. So it was really fun to do and, yeah, shared some stuff we've been kind of cooking up in. Got to meet a lot of people and talk to a lot of people about stuff they're building. And yeah, just like a really good time and really good for the team too, to just be able to take in like, man, like there's people who really use this thing and really love it. So
do you think you'll do another one?
I'd like to, but I don't know when. I don't think it'd necessarily be like an annual thing. I like thinking of it as just like sometimes they pop up and happen type of thing. And we did the Tailwind meetup yesterday just while we were in town here. And that was very much the opposite. It was just like, I just posted on Twitter, does anyone want to host a Tailwind meetup? And we had a handful of people say, yeah, we can help out. And one company in particular, the dude who replied, who worked there, just like nailed it. He like replied with like pictures of a meetup that they'd done the month before, and just like inspired so much confidence in like their ability to host it, and totally took care of everything. And I just like showed up, and there was pizza, and they had all the chairs ready, and all the AV stuff going, and it just was so smooth. It was like, it was amazing. They did like an amazing job. This company, Katowiki of Amsterdam, that hosted it for us. So we had like 100 people show up to that, and it was like waitlisted within 30 minutes of opening the events. I did a dry run of my Rails World talk, and we also had Martin, who's a former core contributor to Bootstrap, to give a talk.
Oh, cool.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. So it was fun. Yeah.
Cool.
It's really cool. How are you feeling about your talk, which is at the time of this recording tomorrow?
It's like 24 hours away. Yeah, pretty good. I think I gave like a dry run of it yesterday, and which was good to sort of figure out what parts were good and what parts weren't. So I have a little bit of surgery to do on it still.
Sure.
To get it ready for tomorrow, but I have a good vision for it, I think, at this point. So, yeah, it should be kind of good. Cool. Well,
I'll speak for the collective we here. I think we're all excited for it. We talk a lot on the podcast about just like different ways we use Tailwind and a lot of ways we try to figure out how to use it with Rails. And so, yeah, we're excited to be guided in how to do that.
Cool. Hopefully it lives up to the promise. It's tricky because for me, giving a Tailwind talk is, imagine David had to give a Rails talk. Like, what the hell would he talk about? You know what I mean? And it's hard to know what's interesting and what's not, because you know every single nook and cranny of the whole thing. What do people know? What do people not know?
Yeah.
What level of familiarity can you like expect from people? Yeah, I think it should be good. I'm going to do a bit of a quick whirlwind sort of, never used it before. Let's build something quick so you kind of get it. And then here's like a handful of tips and tricks that will make your experience better using it as a Rails developer who's sticking to the vanilla Rails way of doing things. So if you're not using React, you're not using any of this other stuff, like, where are the cool kind of corners of Tailwind that maybe aren't advertised on the homepage that you're going to benefit from learning and being able to take advantage of? So should be fun.
It's cool. Kind of in that realm, I know that internally, I think y'all did some work and you have Laravel running with Inertia. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
How was that experience? Because Inertia it works with Rails as well. And so for those listening who might be curious about that, how did that go?
So tailwindui.com, the website where we host all of like the templates that we sell and the components that you can like browse and copy and paste and stuff, that's a big Laravel app. And when we first built it, it was built with like Laravel and like Blade, which is like the Laravel equivalent of an ERB template. And we had some JavaScript sprinkles, you know, with Alpine.js. As we were like adding some more functionality to the site, we started finding that we were having to like reinvent things that we had easier ways of doing. So we had this headless UI library that we built for like React and Vue to support Tailwind UI that makes it easy to do dropdowns and modals and all that sort of stuff. And the second we had to add like a dropdown to the Tailwind UI site, we're doing it with Alpine. It's like, oh my God, like, why am I like implementing all this crazy accessibility stuff from scratch again when we literally maintain a library that makes this easy if we just use like React or Vue? And Jonathan works on our team and he's a creator of Inertia, and just kind of felt like we're redesigning the site anyways. Let's just rebuild the front end with Inertia. So for anyone who's not familiar, I struggle to sort of explain what Inertia is. But the goal of Inertia is to let you build like a very monolithic feeling Rails or Laravel application that has a entirely like React or Vue or Svelte powered front end. So there's not any like Rails server or Laravel server rendered HTML on the front end. You can still do like server-side rendering with a little node server that kind of runs as like a little sidekick process to your app. And that's what we do in production. But the entire front end is rendered entirely like with React or Vue. In our case, we do React. And what Inertia is, it's this like little layer in between like the Rails side and the React side that lets you basically, the way it works in Rails is all the sort of instance variables that you set in your controller that you'd normally have access to in your views, you now have access to those like in your React page component. Imagine like your ERB views that you're rendering with Rails, except it's a JSX file and you have all the power of JavaScript everywhere in the whole thing. It still feels like it's just a legit straight up Rails app. You can do literally everything that you could do with an ERB template, except like the view layer is built with React or Vue or something, which feels like it's like giving your view layer sort of superpowers. So
yeah, you don't have to duplicate like the routes client side, it's still all Rails.
All the routing is defined in your Rails like routes file.
Yeah.
Inertia is like initially inspired by TurboLinks in a lot of ways. So instead of using like an A tag for links, you use like an Inertia link component, which is every React framework has like their own link component for handling their navigation. But that hooks into the Inertia core, which makes a request to the Rails server to basically get like, what are the instance variables for the next page? And it'll do like the navigation for you, load that all up. But ultimately, it doesn't feel at all like the sort of horrible React Rails experience I think a lot of people paint a picture of in their head, where it's, okay, I've got the React front end repo, I've got the Rails API repo, and I'm like making them talk to each other, and I'm using JWTs or to do everything. It feels like a monolithic app,
yeah,
but with all
the ability to just use pure React on the front end. So anyways, like, yeah, we rebuilt tailwinduI.com using Inertia and React just because we wanted to be able to use the up and down arrows on a drop down when you click like your avatar in the top corner of the page. And we wanted to be able to use headless UI for that instead of building it from scratch. So we converted the whole thing over to that. And that's just like been really awesome, actually. It'd be really cool to see it get more adoption in the Rails community, because I do think it's a good way to get a lot of the benefits that you get from a framework like React without all of the sort of negatives that I think like people associate with it in the Rails community. I know Chris Toomey, who used to work at Thoughtbot, that did lots of educational stuff there. He got really into Inertia when it sort of came out and was like doing a lot of stuff with that in Rails. But I haven't really seen many other people talk about using it with Rails at all.
Yeah, it hasn't really. I talked to Jonathan, I think, originally around when he was working on Inertia, because he, if I remember right, he used my like Vue TurboLinks library, which was boot up Vue, tear it down when you use TurboLinks to navigate pages. And it was like, okay, this is definitely hacky, but you can use both. Yeah. And then that really takes it all the way where it's like Rails still decides what gets rendered. And you just have that instead of rendering HTML, it renders your view component template and just give it the data and voila. And you're not worrying about like, got to make a route to render this. And then we got to go fetch the data, another route for that, and just wiring all that nonsense up. But yeah, it doesn't seem like, I mean, it's probably because Turbo came out and fixed a lot of TurboLinks' issues.
Yeah.
But it had that come out, I bet you Inertia would have taken off a lot more, because it seems like the right balance of both where you get all that, because otherwise you got to build stuff from scratch and stimulus, and it's again rebuild all the accessibility things, and you just don't have a great way of doing that without doing it from scratch.
Yeah, it's just a lot of reinventing the wheel. Like every single framework, it feels like we got to build all the same tools over again. Mm. Like we use React for a lot of things, not even necessarily because like we love React as much as because the ecosystem is just so mature and like just really great tools. Like Framer Motion is this incredible animation library that I don't think has an equivalent anywhere. It's so powerful and performant, and you can do like really wild stuff with it. Yeah, if you want to use something else and that doesn't exist, you got to build it yourself.
Yeah, I kind of wish like web components were easier to use, and it could be, you know, your modal tags and your custom tab tags and whatever, but those seem to have their same trade-offs or whatever that solves some things but makes other things just a pain too.
On the topic of web components, from my understanding, it's pretty much impossible to style those with Tailwind. Is that?
I don't even know enough about them. That's because of like a bunch of weird shadow DOM stuff.
Yeah.
I tried to use it the other day, and the articles for doing it are basically like reload Tailwind like inside each element. And I was like, this seems like a lot of work, so I'm not going to do this. But
I don't know a lot about web components, honestly. Like, I think the main criticism that I've heard of web components in the past is that they can't be like server side rendered at all because they're pure.
Well, they, yeah, you got to have on the JavaScript. You can render the HTML for the tag, but the JavaScript's what makes it do anything. So,
if it has child content and stuff, does that not have? Like, I guess that would still be on a server because they would.
Yeah, you can still put HTML inside the modal or whatever component you got. I definitely think the styling stuff is probably one of the main issues with all that.
Well, speaking of reinventing the wheel every time, that's something we talk about a lot. And actually, one of the questions that someone asked on Twitter, which is, how can we make Tailwind UI a first-class citizen in Rails? Current solution is either build your own component library inspired by Tailwind UI and custom JavaScript, or use a React front end, which is not, quote-unquote, the Rails way.
Sure. So that's basically, those two answers are my two answers. I think the thing that would make it easier is if someone wanted to build a unstyled set of primitives with stimulus or something where you could have like drop downs and dialogues and all that stuff that handle all the keyboard navigation and ARIA attributes and all the complex stuff that you need to do to support that. The problem is it's like insanely hard, an insane amount of work. Like, I naively thought when we built the headless UI project that it was just a matter of like going to the WCAG website, reading the table that said when you press up, this should happen. When you press down, this should happen. and seeing what ARIA attributes have to get out on things. I'm like, that's the easy part. You can follow all that and build the thing and it'll work. It's hard is like, okay, someone's got like the Grammarly Chrome extension installed and that shows up in a dialogue. And how does that interact with like a focus trapping solution that you built? Because that's rendered as like thing that's portaled to the end of the body and someone still needs to be able to access it. So we'd have issues where someone's opens up a dialogue, they're typing in a text area in the dialogue, they have the Grammarly extension pop up to correct something, they go to click something in the Grammarly extension and the dialogue closes because considered like an outside click because the Grammarly extension, you know what I mean?
This is
where things become like a total nightmare is where you're doing stuff like that. And yeah, so we are constantly playing like whack-a-mole with that library. Every time you fix one bug, it like introduces a different bug that wasn't there before. And we just spent 3 weeks implementing support for like list virtualization in our like list box and combo boxing because someone's like, well, I need to render 6,000 items in my combo box because that's what I need to do. And and it's really slow when you do that. And it's like, all right, well, I guess we'll spend $45,000 on that, which is like literally the cost of like paying two people to work on that for several weeks.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that I really appreciate what you do is Tailwind is free and you're making money off Tailwind UI and refactoring UI and stuff. But you're still investing all that money to polish all these things to a level that like you don't need to. You absolutely don't need to do that.
In some ways,
but you do in a way,
Bill, though. This is like the curse of selling code is that the standards for the code have to be way higher than if you're just building a product that's code under the hood. If we sell a combo box component example that you can put in your own app, the expectations for that are way higher than if you built a combo box into Podia, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because it only has to solve the exact problems of the people using that site. And all the accessibility stuff, people just put you under a microscope in a way that they don't for like real products. We get like so much critical stuff about little tiny details that like we already do better than like Stripe does in their UI, for example, and no one gives them shit, but they give us shit.
We give Stripe shit. Don't worry.
How do you?
I appreciate that. I appreciate that regardless. Yeah.
But it's nobody else is going to that extent, I feel like. So it's one of those that gives me confidence that like whatever you guys put out, I know will be a super high quality, which is good. But yeah, it's one there. I'm like, that's an interesting thing to try and rationalize as a business owner. Like, what do we do? How do we figure out how to make this? And your last episode about selling one-time products and stuff, where it's like maintaining this forever and you're not paying for it forever. And it's an interesting thing to balance and try and figure out. You're selling to developers who all think they can rebuild that stuff from scratch in a week. And, you know, it's got to be interesting. You know, how do you manage that feeling of just constantly being bombarded by either Tailwind CSS is the dumbest thing in the world or like all these like issues of, okay, do you really need to support 6,000 items in this combo box?
Yeah, you know? A struggle. The Tailwind criticism, I think I just don't care anymore. I think it's
feels a popular. Lot like recent TypeScript situation that we had. A lot of opinionated people talking about something they've never used or whatever.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's cool to dunk on Tailwind. I'm so cool at CSS, I don't need Tailwind. Yeah, here's why you don't either.
Yeah, it's almost a political stance.
That helps. Yeah. Know, because like it helps you just...
Then you can easily
if you can understand someone's like motivation for criticizing something and recognize that it's like this selfish motivation that's not actually related to like criticizing the tool. It's related to weird status seeking behavior. Yeah. It's easier to just dismiss it. So yeah, eventually you just get better at ignoring that stuff. Yeah, the stuff about like investing all this time in like this list virtualization thing, for example, like I think just in general, we just have really high standards for the quality of the stuff we do and taking like bug reports and all that stuff really seriously. Like we're like really fortunate to be in a position where like the company is like very, very, very profitable and we got to spend money on something, you know what I mean? So for better or for worse, I take like our GitHub issue count like really seriously. So across our whole org, we're at like 35 issues or something right now. We had it down to 25. 25 is always my goal because like on the like big crazy filtered bookmark URL that I use to look at all the issues across all the repos together, that's one page. So the pagination bar disappears when you get down to 25.
I was going to say maybe 25 is if we were at zero and when I go to bed, when I wake up in the morning, it's 25. Yeah. Like
when it gets to be not on multiple pages is nice. But, you know, we have a team of guys who work basically full time, just like cranking through GitHub issues. And the other thing with GitHub issues is I feel like if you don't triage them like effectively, you might as well not even be looking at them because 90% of things are just noise anyways. They're not even real bugs. So we are pretty aggressive about like, taking things that's like, someone will open an issue. The MD modifier doesn't work in Tailwind. It's like, if that was true, I would have known. Yeah. That. You know what I mean? So that gets moved to a discussion and someone will try and help that person figure out what the source of that.
We want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Buzzsprout. This episode was made possible because we recorded live at Rails World 2023 in Buzzsprout's sponsored podcast booth. We had an awesome little booth to record at the conference with people who were in attendance. This is actually our first time that Andrew, Jason, and I were able to record together in person live. So it was pretty awesome. And all of that was possible thanks to Buzzsprout. So shout out to them. If you plan on starting a podcast, check out Buzzsprout. You can also easily import your podcast from another hosting service to Buzzsprout as well. So check them out if you would like to try Buzzsprout out for hosting your podcast.
How do you deal with the ones that are like in between, where it's not like definitely a bug and it's maybe not, you know?
Some things are easier to classify as a feature request. Okay, you want this to happen here, but it doesn't currently happen. I wouldn't really consider it a bug. It's just like wasn't really designed to do that. We definitely over time have gotten a bit more aggressive about categorizing things as like feature requests again, because otherwise like you can't really look at GitHub issues as like a strict to-do list anymore. It just becomes like a mishmash, whereas we try to keep everything that's in a GitHub issue is like something that's broken that needs to be fixed. And that keeps it really actionable. And then it's like an honest representation of work.
What do you do with the feature request ones? Because I feel like
I move them over to discussions. And
okay,
just,
that's a good idea.
I just read them and pay attention to what people are asking for a lot and try to take that into consideration.
Yeah, I think I've been unsure of what to do with them. So I leave them in issues and it's like label it with like feature request or something, but then it sits there for maybe 2 years or something and I feel bad and it's like, I don't need the feature. Nobody else made a PR to implement the feature. So it is what it is, but it makes sense to like put it into discussion. It's not really an issue. It's, I like that.
It's hard to manage open source stuff like that. And I know like Caleb Porzio manages like Livewire and Alpine. He just disables issues on all of his stuff completely. And even bug reports go to discussions, which I see some merit to, honestly. Like when you think about what happens when you report a bug in Safari, does it go on some public issue tracker where you can just like look at everything? Maybe it does for WebKit, actually. But for the Apple Notes app, if something goes wrong in that, is everyone entitled to like look at all the bugs? Are you expecting every single bug to necessarily get fixed? You know, I think like HH has, like, he talks about like not every bug is like worth fixing. You know what I mean? There's like an infinite amount of bugs. And I think it's like a useful perspective to sort of have. Sometimes I feel like we spend too much time fixing bugs and almost let it become like a DDoS vector for the company's productivity. Like you basically just let other people control all your time and you don't give yourself enough time to actually like work on the stuff that you strategically want to work on. So yeah, that's another reason why we try to be like really aggressive about filtering stuff out that isn't like real legit bugs.
You seem to really like the discussion features on GitHub.
Yeah, I mean, we use it a lot. Unfortunately, had dreams of our like GitHub discussions area becoming this really rich community of interesting conversations with people sharing like cool things that they were building, and nostalgic to thinking about my message board experiences of like, teenage years. Yeah. We'd have these great communities of people sharing cool stuff. And do you remember when you used to go on message boards and like, people create like tutorials that were just like message board posts?
That was me. You know, I did that's how I started.
That was the home for the tutorial. Like this was like the canonical reference was this like message board post. It wasn't like on someone's blog. The community was so valuable that people were willing to post first party high quality content like directly on the message board.
When I got my first laptop, I was on the Ubuntu forums and it had this giant thread that was like, if you have this laptop, here's every library you install to get the Windows Media Player remote working in Linux and everything. And everybody that I had followed on the forums was making their own, like, I've got the AMD version of this laptop, so it's got different modules and stuff to set up. And I was like, I'm going to make one for my laptop. And like, that was such good times. And that's when eventually I was like, I should buy a domain and put the tutorials on my own site and build a little brand or whatever. But
that's what I wanted GitHub discussions to be. And it's not what it is. It's mostly just like low quality help requests for things, which is still fine. But I mean, I'm so grateful that it exists because it's like a first party place to get things out of issues that we don't consider to be issues.
Yeah, issues get kind of become an overloaded. They
become an issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude, I can rant about GitHub issues. Like I said, the worst thing about GitHub issues, they're like a DDoS vector for maintainers that I don't think is like fully appreciated. The thing I like hate about them the most is that like, there's no way to ignore one. If someone opens like an issue that is just you don't want to deal with or like you don't want to engage with, like you have no way of not engaging with it because closing it is engaging with it. Like if someone knocks on my door to sell me something I don't want to buy, I can just like not answer the door.
Yeah.
But like you can't.
There's no delete so nobody else sees it. And
right.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
I wonder if that's why you see a lot of like GitHub bots. It's like, well, this has become stale, so we're going to automatically close it.
I have this dream of building a bot that automatically closes every single issue and pull request that's opened immediately and putting them into the private queue that I can process. And if I see something that I actually do want to do something about, I open it myself. And then it's like a filter for everything getting into open. And like the subtle difference between that and just looking at everything that's open and closing the things I don't want to deal with is like, I'm not like signaling to the person that I looked at it and closed it. If I like don't want to do anything about it, it's I ignored it. Like right now, there's no ignore option in GitHub, which I don't know. It feels
It's like the same thing if you were expected to answer every email you received,
or if someone or if someone got a notification that you deleted their email from like your inbox. You know, that's effectively like the way it works with GitHub. And sometimes I like fear, man, that people will catch on to that and recognize GitHub as this like place that they can get your attention for things that like you otherwise like don't want to be involved in. I don't really participate in a lot of stuff generally online, but like, if someone wanted to drag you into some like political conversation or something that like you just don't want to really be involved in, like, GitHub is a way for them to do that sort of thing. You know what I mean? And that frightens me.
Yeah. Well, honestly, we saw that just recently in the Rails community where people were upset about the TypeScript thing.
Yeah.
So the repo got bombarded from people opening fake issues, fake pull requests, and just being nasty.
Just vandalizing it, basically.
Well, there's another question that I would like your input on as well. It was asked, effectively, tips for implementing interactive front-end components, so mainly forms and menus without React. They said they currently use L-Transition. Are you familiar with that? EL-Transition? No. It's basically
It's
a stimulus. Well, it's not just stimulus.
It's
but
just a JavaScript
library implementing like transition start, transition end.
Yeah, like it's like extracted the Alpine transition stuff
like
into
interleave transitions.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
And they said they're using that for drop down slide overs. And the question is, what things should I consider when rolling my own JS versus using headless UI? And I think we touched on that a little bit.
It kind of gets to that to that discussion before, but the accessibility stuff and the keyboard navigation and all that stuff, that's like the biggest challenge. So I would reference like the WCAG ARIA guides are really comprehensive and good. And they'll kind of tell you everything that you need to be worried about if you want to make a really robust drop down, which is called a menu in ARIA land. So you need to support like up and down arrow key navigation. There's some like discretionary stuff. If you open a drop down and you go to click another link on the page, should you be able to click it immediately or should you have to, or does clicking close the drop down and then clicking the link works? Like people have different stances on that. Mm-hmm. So details like that.
God damn it.
Is this something you have an opinion on?
I didn't think I did. Now I do. I'm like, had to deal with stuff like that before. It's like, forget
and that's
about
like
it.
Something that I think people think they want to be able to click a link immediately. But then if you go and use like Mac OS or something, if you have like a menu open from the top, you can't click on anything else in Mac OS unless you close it. Here's another thing to consider. You open like a drop down menu on a website. Should you be able to scroll the website while the drop down menu is open? I think on the web, a lot of people feel like they should be able to. But then if you open a Mac OS like native select and you go to scroll, scroll doesn't work.
Let's take a second to thank our sponsor, Honey Badger. The number one reason startups fail is that they run out of money. There's so many ways for startups to lose money. Downtime should not be one. Recent studies found that downtime can cost $427 per minute for small businesses and up to $9,000 per minute for medium-sized businesses. That's every single minute. That's insane. A monthly subscription with Honey Badger helps you prevent costly downtime by giving you all the monitoring you need in one easy-to-use platform so you can quickly understand what's going on and how to fix it, which helps you stay in business. That is good. Best of all, Honey Badger is free for small teams and setup takes as little as 5 minutes. Get started today at honeybadger.io. That is www.honeybadger.io.
You want to go through that site and figure out what all the things you need to consider are. And this is kind of Ryan Florence, who's like a React guy. He like built Remix and like React Router. I think, I don't know if it was a talk or a blog post or something. He talks about this thing that he calls like the curse of React, which is like, and I think this is now not really specific to React. This is specific kind of like the nature of all current front end tooling. And we made it like so easy for people to build superficially like interactive things that it's really easy to make it so when I click this button, this panel opens up and I can hover over things and click things. And that feels like a drop down, but it's like 1% complete. Mm. You've made it like so easy for people to build bad components that they don't realize are bad until someone who can't see tries to use it or something like that. Whereas back in the day where we were all using like jQuery UI, it was like the one UI framework and it had just been like battle tested into like oblivion and it handled all that stuff perfectly. Mm. But as soon as you make it easy for people to build them from scratch, all of a sudden all of them are missing like 95% of these like critical edge case important features that were built into like the shared tooling that we used to use in the day. So I think we're in like a bit of a weird period right now where we're getting tools like Stimulus and Vue and Svelte also are still kind of light in some of these abstractions. React has the most, I think, because it has sort of like the biggest community. But where we haven't like filled in those gaps yet with the primitives that people need to be able to build these things custom from scratch, but all sharing some community effort put into the complicated edge casey, keyboard navigation-y, focused wrapping, outside clicking, you know, insane complex stuff that you need to get right for these things to actually be robust.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's missing and it's like a huge pain point for me. David talked about Hotwire and then I went to a Hotwire talk like right after it and that is all really exciting. But every time I Rails new, I feel like I'm reinventing the wheel, like trying to build front end components. And then I'll go to like TLN UI and I'll hit the React drop down and I'll copy and paste it. And everything just works. And it makes me so mad to the point where I'm like, maybe I should just be using Inertia and just using components that you have two people putting 45 hours into one little issue.
And there's like another outside the box solution too, right? Which is just like design the UI differently.
Right.
Thought you were going to say go back to jQuery UI.
Oh, you could do that too. But instead of opening a dialog, just go to a new page. Mm-hmm. You know, all the outside click concerns and focus trapping concerns disappear. If you play around with the actual Basecamp website a lot, there's a lot of different moving, navigating between pages to achieve things instead of opening interactive stuff. But if you're trying to build something like linear or something where it tries to feel like all on the screen at the same time, different things popping up everywhere, it's a lot more complicated. But that's like another way to sort of just avoid the problem. But yeah, if you want to build those really dynamic interactive experiences, unfortunately, it's a lot of work. And outside of the React ecosystem, I kind of feel like you're starting really behind.
Yeah. You kind of answered this, but I was going to ask, because I know a lot of the stuff that comes out of Tailwind Labs is React and some Next stuff. And I was curious because I remember like you had an advanced Vue course back in the day. And I know Vue's pretty popular in Laravel community as well. So yeah, kind of curious some of the reasons you kind of lean so heavy on React.
It kind of just happened over time. Like, I still really love Vue as a project and respect it a lot. And I think Evan is like a brilliant person. And I love like his work on Vite and stuff like that. I think when I got kind of converted, I guess, was when we needed to build like all these components for Tailwind UI. We wanted to add like the interactive versions because like when we originally released Tailwind UI, it was like bring your own JavaScript. That was sort of like the whole story. And when we wanted to provide working JavaScript versions of things, I wanted to do Vue, but I also felt like there's more people using React than Vue, so we also need to do React. So we want to support both. And the people on our team actually had more experience with React than Vue. So like we were rebuilding tailwindcss.com. It used to be like a jigsaw site, which was like a static site built for Laravel way back in the day. And not even Laravel, really, but using Laravel's templating engine. And we built it with Next.js, not really because we liked React, but because we liked Next. Because it felt like this really simple way to build those types of sites, but still have like interactive features and stuff. And there's like Nuxt in Vue. But at the time, Next felt more powerful because, and I think like it's also timing specific. I think at the time, Next had MDX support and Nuxt didn't. You know, so like we leaned on Next, which got us like more into the React world. And so now like the Tailwind CSS website's built with Next, and that's React. And that's like our biggest website. So of course we're developing more expertise with React and stuff like that. Yeah. So a lot of it just came down to, it doesn't really make sense for us to like use multiple frameworks for our own stuff. The Tailwind docs are built with React. Okay. Well, next thing we build should probably just be with React too, because that's where we're getting good. And when I started using React, there are some benefits of it that I overview that I did not expect to feel as important. And the absolute number one benefit is that you can have multiple React components in a single file. So because React is quote unquote like just JavaScript, which it's like it's JSX, which is not really JavaScript, but ultimately it is kind of still just JavaScript. It's more just JavaScript than like a Vue single file component is just JavaScript. You can just create components, as many as you want in a file, and reference them just like function names and stuff like that. Whereas in Vue, the convention is you have a .vue file. It's got a template section, a script section, and there's one component per file. And if I'm making, say, like a table component in Vue, there's going to be a file called table.vue, table row.vue, table cell.vue, table header.vue. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas in React, I can just have table.jsx and all those components are just in there. And I found that the workflow of creating custom components in React, when you have the flexibility to just like quickly extract a component to like a couple lines above where you're currently working, just to see if that abstraction feels right, it was so freeing compared to in Vue where it's like, okay, I want to try putting this into a separate component, but I'm really confident enough in this experiment that I want to go and create a new file for it. So I found that in Vue, my components tended to be bigger. And in React, they all tended to be smaller because the cost of extracting them felt like a lot lower. And I did not expect that difference to feel like so significant, because I don't see people talk about that as much as the benefit of React over Vue. But that was the thing that felt like this meaningful difference to me. Everything else about it is like the same. Vue, in a lot of ways, has taken things, learned things from React and made different decisions that I think the React team wouldn't agree are like improvements, but like for a lot of people do feel like improvements. Like in React, there's all these crazy rules about like you can't call use state in an if statement and stuff like that. Whereas in Vue, when they implemented the composition API, it runs once instead of on every render. So none of those rules apply, and it's kind of simpler in a lot of ways. And Vue has better performance than React for a lot of things too. So yeah, at the end of the day, it really just came down to, okay, well, we built the Tailwind CSS website with React. Now we're getting better at React. We're developing expertise there. And then also, there's all these great libraries in React we're using, like Framer Motion and stuff like that. And it felt to me like a Vue was behind ecosystem-wise in terms of that stuff. And it also kind of felt like everything that did end up in Vue was like derivative of a library in React. And this is like no criticism of Vue the library or like the people maintaining Vue, but the Vue community kind of seemed to work that way, where it's like, look at this cool React library, we should port that to Vue. Oh, look at this cool React library, we should port it to Vue.
That's what we do with Laravel.
It never felt like the other way around. You know what I mean? So it's like, feels like if I'm going to pick an ecosystem, why don't I pick the one where everything happens here first? Yeah. So that's kind of how we ended up there. I never used React prior to like React hooks either. Okay. So I think that was like another big thing. React class components felt like pretty big and nasty to me, but
they are
this really lightweight, like you just make a function and it's so sexy looking.
It is. It feels like it unlocks part of your brain that you didn't know was there before. Cause like we have some class-based components still at Podia, and like we haven't touched them in years, and I'll go back and I'm like, God, this is a mess. Like I'm embarrassed about most code I write, but that especially is a hell of a ride. One thing I also say, somebody responded and said, can you tell him thank you? Tailwind gets a lot of love, but also a lot of hate that outshines the appreciation.
I appreciate that.
I think a lot of us like Laravel stands. So, not Laravel, Tailwind stands.
since 2017 when it came out.
Me too.
It's college.
And then also someone. Yeah. Do you know what a message board is, by the way?
No, I don't know what a message board is. I figured from context, it's like a forum.
Yeah.
It's forum. There you go. Yeah.
And then the last question from someone was, they're curious how much Laravel you get to do these days, because they said your Laracon talks are some of the best with the finesse emoji.
Thank you. My most popular Laracon talk is a complete ripoff of a DHH keynote that was like lost on the web and never captured on YouTube, that I actually like screen recorded it from like a flash based website where it was still online and uploaded to YouTube. Yeah, I don't write much Lara about myself these days. Like I said, our main web app that we maintain is still written in Laravel, but like actually no one at the company really writes a lot of Laravel just because the site doesn't change.
Right.
It sure. Just kind of is built and it works. Most of my coding time, I don't really do as much coding in general as I'd even really like, and that's something I'm actively trying to like spend more of my time doing. But lately I'm just building. We're working on this like React UI kit. So I'm building a lot of components with React, or I'm working in Node, making improvements to Tailwind, because that's what Tailwind ends up being written in, is like, you know, Node APIs and JavaScript.
Right.
But yeah, I don't get to touch Laravel much anymore, sadly. But well,
you were like, I assume you still are, you were such like an integral part of that community. When I first kind of got into web development, my first professional job was about the time Refactoring to Collections came out. I wasn't even writing PHP and I bought that book. Like, I was awesome. Like, I don't know. I just, because we have a lot of enumerable stuff in Ruby. And so
that's
like,
where that stolen from Ruby too.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Same with my test-driven Laravel course. That's basically like me reading like the RSpec book and ThoughtBot test-driven Rails. Yeah. And like basically combining funny. All this information, figuring out how to apply it in PHP and turning it into a course.
I love the overlap between the two communities. I think it's cool.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that's like a reason I'm most excited to be at Rails World. Like, I've literally never written a line of Rails until 3 days ago when Chris helped me set up a Rails app for like my talk. Yeah. But I feel like I've followed the community so closely for so long, because similar to like what I've kind of been saying about like React, I kind of felt like so much innovation happened in the Rails world in terms of just like building web applications. Like, yeah, when I wanted to learn like TDD, I had to learn it by seeing how people were doing it in Rails. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really cool to be able to participate in this, because it's been such a huge influence on me, even though I never ended up running Rails new or whatever a single time in my life. I still consider myself like a diehard like Rails sort of fan.
Were you the one that made the WWDHHD stickers?
Yeah.
What would DHH do? I love those. So awesome. There are a lot of people, it's not like necessarily like the vocal majority, but a lot of people do use React like with Rails.
Yeah.
So
a lot more than you would.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be an API app and a front end app. Like, you can mix them together.
Yeah, you can just like mount React to a div somewhere type of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We do that at Podia.
Yeah, we do that all over not all over the place, but we do that where appropriate.
Yeah. So I think it's relevant. I think it's good to talk about that stuff, because a lot of times the conversation is just server rendered HTML and Rails. And so it's good to have someone with your React knowledge join us. And
for sure. Do you guys have any Tailwind questions?
Well, I want to know if there's any like CSS changes coming up. Any CSS changes coming up that you're looking forward to?
There's some pretty low level things that most people won't interact with that I'm excited about because of some internal details in Tailwind. So here's a real close to the metal nerdy one, but have you guys ever looked at the output from Tailwind and noticed that on the universal selector we render 900 CSS variables? You know how like in Tailwind we let you do things like combine like a scale utility with a rotate utility utility, and that even though at the end of the day that all ends up targeting one property, which is like transform. So the only way that can possibly work is for the scale utility, it doesn't actually set the transform property. It sets a CSS variable to a certain value, and then the transform property reads from that variable. So if you look at like what happens in Tailwind when you use one of those transform utilities, you'll see like transform colon space and then like var dash dash scale x, var dash dash scale y, var dash dash rotate, var dash dash whatever.
Yeah.
And those are like these conceptual sort of slots in the sort of transform property that those utilities like fill in with values. But the only way for that to work is if like on every single element, we reset those variables back to like blank so that when you nest an element inside a rotated element, it doesn't get double rotated because it's inheriting the rotate value from like the parent. Right? It's really weird stuff. Yeah, the way that we have to do that is by like on the star selector, the universal selector, we have to basically, so every single element on the page has like literally probably like 40 CSS variables on it that are set to basically like default values. So for the rotate, it might be zero, scale, it might be zero. But for then other weird things, we do the same thing for like, what is it called? Like a font variant numeric property.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Set
like tabular nums. And yes. Stuff. There's like multiple slots there that you can compose to where maybe you want to say it's fractional or whatever, like stacked fractions and tabular nums at the same time. And Tailwind gives you like utilities for that. But those ones, there's no zero value. The only value is like blank. So you see a lot of variables that are like dash, dash, tabular nums, colon, then just space, semicolon, which a lot of people like open issues on Tailwind saying like, Tailwind's generating invalid CSS. And I'm like, read the spec. It's not invalid. It's important.
And you wish you could just close it without having to respond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, that stuff that we have to do unfortunately causes some performance issues in Safari on sites that have 6,000 or more DOM nodes, which includes tailwindcss.com, sadly. So we did this like weird optimization in Tailwind where we figured out a way where instead of setting those variables on every single element using the star selector, Tailwind like only sets them on the elements where you've used it on, which is not too hard when you're just thinking about the utilities that are affected. But when someone starts using apply, all of a sudden it's like you did apply X10. Now I need to make sure that this weird selector that you wrote, where you've used apply, gets reset to that. But I can't use that whole selector because it's got a specificity of 1.7, and now utilities won't override it. So I have to find the thing in there that has the lowest specificity and extract it. And so there's all this complexity in there. Anyways, there's this new feature coming to CSS that's in all browsers now. I think maybe just in like Firefox, like nightly, but will probably be like usable by like next year, called at property, that lets you define a custom property, like the shape of a custom property. Oh. So not just like set a custom property with a value. I can say, so just like, for example, we have like a rotate X property or whatever. I can say at property rotate X, where there's going to be a custom property on this site called rotate X. This is like what the default value should be. This is what the type of it is, so that like you can animate it from like certain values, which like you can't normally do without specifying the type. And importantly, we can say, like, does this custom property inherit? So if you have it set on the parent, should it be inherited to the child elements? Because there are properties in CSS that don't inherit and some do. So when you're defining a custom property, you need the ability to do that. So by using this property thing soon, we'll be able to say, here's all these insane reset variables that Tailwind uses for all this stuff. We're just going to define those in preflight, and we can say inherits false. And now all that asterisk crazy logic extracting low specificity selectors from things, delete. The browser will just handle it all for us. So that's an obscure CSS feature that most regular end users are probably like never going to think about or touch. That's going to be life changing for us. So I'm excited to use that one, for instance.
Are there ever any instances of like Tailwind specifically like pushing any CSS features forward in browsers?
Not really that I can think of. We uncover like browser bugs pretty regularly, and we have contacts on like the Firefox and Chrome teams that like fix the browser bugs for us right away, which is crazy to have that influence at this point.
Reminds me of, was it Sam or Javon who like had a screenshot of Chrome or something has a special exception in it for the Trix editor or whatever. Yeah, and I was like, you got to be pretty proud to like the browser did an exception for our thing.
Yeah. But I don't think there's much that we've done to push the CSS stuff forward. I talk to Luna on the Chrome team like every month or two.
It's cool.
She's like a developer relations person there that relays like any feedback we have to them. And she keeps me in the loop with all like the new CSS stuff and helps me like find ways that we can use it in Tailwind, which is really helpful. But yeah, on the CSS like working group side of things, like we don't really have a lot of influence there. I think most of the people who are excited about that stuff just hate Tailwind so much that it wouldn't really want to talk to us about it. But yeah, there's lots of new cool CSS stuff coming. Like CSS nesting is like, it's exciting for us for some internal reasons because it lets us re-implement a lot of the way things work in Tailwind when nesting, which will simplify a lot of things. I don't think I'm ever going to want to write nested CSS in like a CSS file. Sure. I think that's like the source of most CSS maintainability issues personally. Huh. But for us, it simplifies a lot of things. So if you think about how in Tailwind you can do like hover, colon, underline, and you might do LG, colon, hover, right. colon, underline. Yeah. Yeah. Or you might do dark, colon, LG, colon, hover, colon, underline. If we implement like each one of those like modifiers as just like a nested rule, the browser just magically like handles that for us, you know? So it's like, oh, you add hover? Okay, so we're just going to like, so here's your selectors like dot underline and inside it just has like text decoration underline. Okay, so we're just going to pull the rule out. We're just going to stick a little wrapper in there that says ampersand hover. Okay, and now it like works. We don't actually have to modify the selector. We can just like, keep adding these like layers of wrapping inside of it. And every modifier just maps to like one specific selector nesting wrapper. Yeah. And they just become all nested stuff. And so that's we cool. actually are re-implementing a lot of stuff in Tailwind to work that way. And we're using Lightning CSS to flatten all the nesting because I still kind of feel like even though browsers support nesting, if we just shipped the nesting that like we want to do, the browser would be like, what are you doing to me? No, we're supposed to use it this way. Which I think
you're
is
you're now the guy asking for the combo box with 6,000
exactly. That, we are that to the browser developers, 100%.
That's funny.
That's like before Tailwind 3, when the unpurged Tailwind file was like 4 megabytes. Open the Chrome DevTools and all of a sudden the Chrome would stop working. Like, oh. Like I can open a bug in Chrome that's like Chrome DevTools is unresponsive when you have a 4 megabyte style sheet, and they're going to be like, yeah, it'd be unresponsive with like a 6 gigabyte style sheet too. Like, what's the limit here? You know? So,
well, it's fun to watch the progress of Tailwind. Like, even from the days like you're talking about when it was just one style sheet. Like, I feel like every incremental thing you've added has been valuable. The arbitrary values is the name of the feature with the square bracket.
I love that.
Yeah. I use that all the time. I love recently combining using data attributes because it saves me from running like conditional ERB logic where I can just now do this with pure HTML. I love it. So thank you for all your work on that.
Thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Adam, thanks so much.
Thanks guys.
Thanks for being here.
Sweet.